You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. Although Amy Butcher teaches creative writing at Ohio Wesleyan University, she often spends her summers teaching students at the Sitka Fine Arts Camp, and her experiences in Alaska have found a way into her work. So here to talk about her new book, Mother Trucker, is Amy Butcher. Hello, Amy, and welcome to the show.
Hi, Shelley. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you very much for being here. Before we get into talking about the book, tell me about yourself. How did you become a writer?
Sure. I've known that I wanted to write ever since I was a child. And it was through, I think, both my undergraduate and then my graduate experience in writing programs that really showed me, I think, the power of harnessing true narratives in particular. And that's a gift that I get to share not only with my students here in Ohio, but every summer with middle school and high school youth in Sitka, Alaska. Mm.
Well, just the name of your new book catches the ear, Mother Trucker. It's a real life story about a female truck driver. But it wasn't the story you set out to write. What had you intended to do, and how did that change?
Sure, absolutely. This book began largely about my fascination with Alaskan haul road trucker Joy Ruth Wiebe, who was the only female ice road trucker on the James W. Dalton Highway, hauling anything from structural materials and infrastructure materials to piping and other supplies. I found Joy on Instagram. She was something of an Instagram celebrity with over 11,000 followers, which at the time seemed pretty fantastic. Yeah. And I was captivated by her world and this idea that she worked this male-dominated industry and this really harsh and remote landscape. And that was deeply attractive to me. So I initially intended to have the book be really exclusively a profile of Joy and the work that she did in rural and northern Alaska. But ultimately, the book also widens and broadens to become a conversation about the epidemic of intimate partner violence and the way in which so much of what made Joy strong, and certainly my own story as well in wanting to travel and meet Joy, was largely had to do with what we experienced in our private lives, which is to say both Joy and I, through our conversations, came to realize that we both had experience with violent men and with abusive men. And that's something that the book explores as well.
Hmm. Well, not to give away too much, but this is a story that, as you already sort of touched on, is both joyful and sad at the same time. Is it nonfiction? Is it fiction? What is like the story about?
Yeah, it's nonfiction. That's a great question. It really is sort of a combination of memoir in terms of my own story, but also sort of literary journalism in the way in which it explores who Joy is and profiles her. But there's also elements, I think, of cultural criticism, of travel writing. And I was certainly very interested, of course, too, in northern Alaska, in the Dalton Highway, in the oil fields of Prudhoe Bay, and the industrial complex of Dead Horse. So the book kind of juggles a lot of different balls, if you will, but this is exclusively nonfiction. So it's a true story that I've worked very hard to bring to life on the page.
Would you like to read us an excerpt?
I would love to.
And Amy, sorry, I know we talked about this before we went live, but you could read the longer version if you'd like.
Sure, absolutely. Thank you for that. This comes from really about the middle of the book, where for the first time, Joy and I are driving in her truck on the Dalton Highway. And for the first time, I'm beginning to talk openly about perhaps what brought me to Alaska, the impetus for my trip. That spring, as the daffodils pushed up and the tulips birthed bright color, I began drinking heavily, and Dave began drinking heavily, and all of the time spent between us became a series of small combustions, like kerosene, like fire. I was sad all the time, I told Joy. I often groveled. I didn't recognize the woman that I had become. I'd compromised myself out of my beliefs. I told her about Dave and our increasingly hostile relationship. The worst of his rage, of course, but also the way he could be so gentle. How it seemed, I told her then, that he took pleasure in taking care of me after making me feel small. And then he leaves, I said. And then especially, I turn into someone that I don't know. I plead into the phone. I beg him to come back. It was as if I was so empty, I told her, so hollowed out that I didn't even care which version of him greeted me upon his return. Half the time, he terrifies me. And the other half, I swear, it's like he's the only person in the world who matters. Isn't that insane? It wasn't, she said, insane. She told me of a study in which scientists determined that domestic abuse lights up the same neurotransmitters as gambling. I felt addicted to pulling levers. I wanted triple cherries. Everything I did became a means of acquiring the kind of kindness and generosity that Dave routinely afforded others, of trying to win one kind of love, of trying to avoid the others. I thought that this is what it meant to love, to hurt and still to love, and to fear and to love then too. Think of it like a casino, she told me. You walk in there knowing you're going to lose, but there's this small chance that you might win, go home big, receive all you've ever wanted, and so it keeps you coming back. It's what kept me coming back. This, the very real, very tricky problem of loving a man who is cruel to you, you begin to think that the intensity of their outbursts indicates the intensity of their passion, that there is never tenderness without cruelty, and that cruelty, in fact, is not a byproduct, but a symptom of their love. We're going to get you out of there, she told me, by which she meant get you out. I'll stop there.
Wow, that was not exactly what I expected, but I really enjoyed hearing it. I think a lot of people can relate to those mixed feelings about a partner in a relationship like that. How did writing this book, how did writing this book, completing the book, change you or inspire you?
Sure. I mean, so I think the book in many ways couldn't be more timely. When I started this book, all I knew was that largely I wanted to escape my life here in Ohio for reasons that I think this passage mentions. And I saw and enjoyed this woman who demonstrated herself both online and it seemed in the real world to be fiercely strong and independent and resilient. And I thought that I had something that I might learn from her. And I wasn't wrong, but I also would say that in the process of writing this book, certainly in discovering Joy's own experience, I certainly did research indicating how prevalent domestic violence is and how frequently it's not, again, something that we're very comfortable talking about. But I think, again, in the same way that I certainly had this public-facing persona and was dealing with something very tricky and difficult in my own life at home, that was Joy's story too. And for her, it was deeply important that if I was going to write a profile of who she was, which is to say the strong woman working this male-dominated industry in arguably one of the toughest landscapes in the world, she also wanted the reasons that she pursued this work, which is to say that it provided her a steady salary and financial independence if she had to leave. And so profiling the full extent of Joy was deeply important to me, and also talking about the prevalence of intimate partner violence as well.
Mm. You spent some time with her out on the road, right? What was that experience
like? I did, absolutely.
Yeah, what was that experience like for you?
It was wild. I mean, the book chronicles our journey together. I essentially, after months of following Joy online, I called her and said, this is going to sound crazy. I'm an Ohio professor and writer, and I would really love to fly up to Alaska and drive the Dalton Highway with you in your truck. And I expected, no, absolutely not. I'm a stranger. But, Joy really laughed and said, sure. And within 2 weeks, I was standing in the Spring Hill Suites in downtown Fairbanks, and she was picking me up. And so, I think a lot of what this book is about is the friendships that women in particular forge with each other. I think it's about sort of the secrets that so many of us keep, even from those closest to us. And I think largely it's a testament to the power of female friendship. As many in Alaska might know, Joy was killed very abruptly on that highway 3 months after we did our trip together. And, I had intended to come back a month later and travel that road with her in September, October of 2018. And she was killed instantly when her truck overturned in August of 2018. Oh. So in many ways, the book is sort of a tribute to her, but also to what I think is possible between two women as well.
Wow. I had read that she passed away and how she died. I'm going back to the earlier part of your answer there. I wonder if she even really thought that you meant it when you said you were going to come up to Alaska. A lot of people say they're going to come up and visit me. They never do. So I wonder if she said, yeah, meaning, yeah, right.
Maybe. I think you're absolutely right. But I also, the people that I've met since Joy passed, and actually the people who have read the book and written me who knew Joy, really say that speaks to her character. She was someone who was wildly open to getting to know and meeting other people on their level. And I also think it speaks to, in some way, never tell a writer yes unless you mean it, because I think writers are hungry for stories. And I know I was certainly very hungry to meet Joy and write about her.
How did her death affect you?
it was really difficult. You know, as I mentioned, I had done the trip with her in April of 2018. And because, you know, wanting to be thorough as a writer, I intended to come back up in September, October and do the trip again. We spent that time in April, obviously sharing the inner space of a truck cab for 15 hours up the Dalton Highway, you know, overnight, 15 hours back, and then some time in Fairbanks. So it sounds very strange, but we got very close. I think there's a level of comfort that you reach when you're in a car or in a vehicle with someone for that long. And so it was really devastating personally. It was also very tricky in terms of the book because I would never want this book to be about her death. She worked a highway that has been, you know, called the loneliest road, the most isolated road, and the most dangerous road in America. And that's part of what attracted me to Joy. But I also think, you know, she's so much more than her death. And in many ways, I think her death speaks to the broader epidemic that, you know, so many women feel that they have to make decisions based on their security and what will allow them to prosper and to thrive, especially in situations like the one that Joy experienced throughout her life, which was marred by domestic violence and abuse.
You're just joining me. I'm speaking with Amy Butcher. She's the author of the book Mother Trucker. Amy, who are some authors that you admire, that inspire you, that you maybe influenced you to write this?
Wow, that's a beautiful question. I've been reading a lot of Melissa Phoebos. She has a really wonderful new collection of essays out called Girlhood. I also love the writer T. Kara Madden, who has a beautiful memoir in sort of fragment forms called Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls. I'm really taken by the essay form, which is a form of creative nonfiction. So there's another author, Lacey M. Johnson, who has a collection called The Reckoning. And all of those works were hugely influential to me as I worked on this project.
Well, I'll have to take those as recommendations. I haven't read any of them. Well, thanks so much for joining me on the show today. Where can we get a copy of your book? Is it available wherever books are sold?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, thank you, Shelley. It's certainly available at independent bookstores, and it's so important to support those. But you can also find it, of course, online, Amazon, as well as other vendors. And it came out 2 weeks ago, so it's out and available.
Congratulations. How did you celebrate?
Gosh, how did I celebrate? You know, I'm a professor, so it was a long day of teaching. It was a Monday. It was like most other Mondays. But I did have, I heard from some wonderful friends throughout Alaska, primarily friends rooted in Sitka, and that was really lovely as well.
Oh, that's great. Well, it was really nice chatting with you, Amy. I'm glad you reached out to come on the show and talk about the book Mother Trucker. It sounds like a fantastic read.
Thank you so much, Shelley. I so appreciate your time. Thanks.
Take care. Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years with 7 cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno, more at heritagecoffee.com. In September of 2020, award-winning author and journalist Farai Chidea launched a one-hour show for NPR called Our Body Politic. It's unapologetically centered on how women of color experience the major political events of today and, more importantly, how they are impacting those very issues. KTOO began carrying Our Body Politic last month, starting October 6th, and it airs at 8 p.m. on 104.3, right after the 7 p.m. repeat broadcast of this show. Recently, I got a chance to talk to Farai about her show and her story. Farai Chidea, there's so much to say about you, but would you please introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Farai Chidea. I'm the host of Our Body Politic, which is a show by and about women of color and how we navigate the political space for the good of all. You know, I really feel like what we try to do is point out the leadership of Black women, Latinas, Asian Americans, Pacific Islanders, Indigenous people, you know, Indigenous women. Like, you know, we interviewed our second or third week, we interviewed Representative Deb Haaland, who's now, of course, Secretary of the Interior. And we just were like, you know what? We want to put some shine on how different types of women of color, conservative, liberal, and neither, are navigating power in a divided America.
You're known as an author, as you mentioned, a TV pundit. You're a policy analyst. You're an award-winning journalist. Now you're a host, producer of an NPR talk show and podcast. But where would you say you got your start?
I got my start, first of all, in my house. You know, both of my parents had worked as journalists before I was born. And, you know, unfortunately, race and gender definitely played a role in, you know, my mother not being able to stay in that career. She'd gone to grad school and been an intern at the Washington Post and things like that. So there was a bittersweetness to it, but she always loved the news and repped for the news. And it was mandatory listening and reading. Like, part of our job as soon as we were old enough was to read the newspaper every day and watch the network TV news every night. And that was just part of what was considered, you know, good for us as learners, good for us as citizens, good for us as family. My family are ace political debaters at the dinner table. And, you know, it really allowed me to, you know, understand that this was something that you could talk about. And we disagreed, but we didn't disagree in that toxic, I hate you way. Do you know what I mean? Like, my family has a mix of like Black Republicans, Black independents, white people who've married into the family, mixed race people, liberals, you know, probably one socialist, you know, but I'd have to ask. You know what I mean? It's like, what can I say? We have a lot of fun with each other. And so that was my first training ground. And then I became a reporter right after college, working for Newsweek magazine. I mean, not a reporter, a fact checker, and then a reporter. But I was still in my early 20s when I was a Washington reporter.
Wow. Well, let's talk a little bit about the show, Our Body Politic. We just started carrying it here on KTOO. As we mentioned,
KTOO.
You're welcome, and thank you. And as we talked about earlier, the show is just about a year old, and it's called Our Body Politic. What inspired that name?
You know, there's the phrase, the body politic, which is about, you know, the sort of intellectual and social corpus of voters and citizens. And, you know, and I thought that what was missing was our body politic for women of color, that our bodies often were not represented in the halls of power in the same way as people from other demographics. And so let's bring our full selves into that space, you know? So I feel like it was just something where it was a nice little turn of phrase that you know, has a couple of different meanings.
I like it. It's very apt. So how does Our Body Politic stand out from other NPR programs?
You know, I think that we manage to cover really heavy things without it being despairing. Like, one thing a lot of people like about the show is that we'll cover heavy things and then we'll laugh, or we'll cover heavy things and tell some personal stories about, you know, who we are and what our origin story is. And, you know, and so it's just really, it's really nice. And we have people on who are good at pattern recognition, who can tell you, like, not just is this what's happening today, this is what's probably going to happen tomorrow. And, you know, I think that women of color are really good at pattern recognition because often we have to survive. You know, like, I'm not going to lie, you know, being a woman of color, I'm 52 now. My mother turns 80 on Christmas Day, God willing. And I was lucky to grow up in an intergenerational family, not all in the same household, but we were like on Sundays, we'd go to mass and, you know, I'd see my great grandmother and there'd be great great aunts sometimes, and certainly great aunts and uncles. And in the history of being a Black woman in America, and very often other types of women of color in America, is having to predict the near future to save your own life, job, or family. And that is just something that we tap into, you know, is when you really need to understand complex systems, and America is one complex system, in order to survive, you do it. And that's part of the mix of lived experience and professional experience. So we have contributors who are economists, technologists, doctors, et cetera, but they all bring their lived experience to the table.
You do a regular segment, a roundtable with your guests called Sipping the Political Tea. What made you, what made you create that sort of show within the show?
Oh, you know, it is just, first of all, I was getting sick of just hearing interviews, you know, hearing my own voice, but so many times, and I'm still in the roundtables, most of them, but not all of them. But it's one of these things where it was like, let's just chop it up. You know, there's Washington Week and all these other stately shows that are wonderful in their own ways. But you can't get, you can't like crack certain types of jokes, you know, and have your girlfriend moments in that setting. And we wanted to be having the same levels of conversation, but with a little bit more fun and a little bit more wisecracking. And not just, it's not just fun. It's like, you know, one week we did a wellness check, you know, like we're doing the news and then we're like, things are depressing. How are you? It's like, well, you know, my pickup truck broke and my dog died and whatever, you know, it's like, we were all just in it, you know? And we just talked about that because I think that the news can either be a wonderful connection to the world or it can be a public health disaster because it's affecting your mental health. And so you have to have some understanding that it's okay to be processing your emotions while you're processing information.
How would you describe your interviewing style?
You know, I think it's evolving. Sometimes I'm very, you know, like even now, sometimes I sort of stop and take long pauses and I'm really thinking through what's the question. Other times I kind of go off on a soliloquy and I'm talking my way through to what the right question is. Sometimes, like in a recent interview with Professor Anita Hill, I will have a guest who has a book or something and I will quote back passages of the book and get them to reflect on what they meant by something. And so it's like a little bit of a textual analysis. You know, so all of it is really about, I think each interview requires a different approach to really get the most out of it. Some of my interviews have been deeply personal. Others are just really straightforward, informational, and some are a mix.
I definitely want to talk more about your interview with Professor Anita Hill. I should have grabbed one of your books and read you a passage.
Oh, no, that's so sweet.
I wish I had done that. I think that it's interesting that you describe your style as evolving. It's a good reminder that even, I think, like a top-notch professional like you, who has so much experience and always sounds so unruffled on the air, still considers herself to be growing and learning and improving. So that's kind of on a personal note, inspiring.
You got to keep growing, and it requires a certain amount of reflection, but also a certain amount of just letting go of perfectionism. You know, all of us, I mean, most people I know who are radio hosts are super critical of their own voices. And sometimes we have to be a little kinder to ourselves as we listen to ourselves, because other people like the sound of our voice probably more than we do. And so part of it is just about remembering to have fun with what we're doing too.
I really love your delivery style, but I do have to say it's very serious. And I just wonder, is that just who you are? Is that a part of your persona or is that game face?
You know, it's both. I think as the show evolves, I think we will get looser. You know, it's sort of like, when people play an instrument, they often start out playing in formulaic ways to learn it, and then they improvise. And for me, I'm still actually learning. I've been a radio host, obviously, for years, but I'm still learning, what does it mean to have a news show, news analysis, news commentary show that covers these heavy topics and what is my voice. And I'm definitely not serious all the time, but I won't lie. I've been in a period, particularly, you know, since the beginning of the pandemic, where I've been really deeply analytical about where we're going as a society and what the pressure points are. My sister happens to work in public health, so I got a lot of information about the pandemic early on, and that was one reason I wanted to start the show. So I think that once, you know, I think I will get a lot looser. It's just, it's still improvisation. It's still a learning curve for me. You know, this show is still a learning curve.
How much of the show is your own? And do you have a big role in shaping the episodes, selecting topics, selecting guests?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I have a big role, but it's a big role within a collaborative system. So we have a team. I would say that there's probably, depending on, you know, who's on what week, 5 to 6 people who have an editorial hand in each episode. You know, this is not full-time staff. It's basically all of us. I mean, I had a separate full-time job until recently, because I wanted to see if we could fund the show. And I also have been raising the money for the show. I've raised just over $1 million so far. Oh, wow. You know, for the show. So that was my third job. My first job was my job. My second job was the show. Third job was fundraising for the show. And all, you know, everything worked out. I gave 6 months notice to my full-time job. And so now I think, you know, our processes will change, but it's basically been like 6 part-time people. Sometimes 1 or even 2 people won't work on the show in a week, but we try to cycle through brainstorming story ideas, but I come up with a lot. Sometimes I do my own prep. Other times, most times, a producer does the prep. So, you know, yeah.
Well, let's talk about politics. Mm-hmm. I have some questions for you about how you navigate certain aspects of that. So you're an experienced award-winning journalist, as we've already said, and politics is one of, if not your, the area of expertise. And you've covered the last 6 presidential elections. What draws you to that beat, I guess?
Yeah, so I think it's, again, my family engagement. And it's also that, like, to be honest, this show isn't one of the things that's been a mixed bag for me about doing this show is that we've spent so much time with politicians. My love of in political reporting is doing interviews with local people. Like, that's my favorite thing, is to show up someplace and talk to people and find out what they're thinking and why they're thinking it. And talking to politicians was really not the goal of what I wanted to do, but we still want politicians, but actually sometimes I feel like our best interviews are the non-politician interviews, you know, because politicians, for obvious and understandable reasons, often can be very scripted. And, you know, we try to get them outside of their box, but sometimes that succeeds and sometimes that doesn't. A lot of times it's, you know, it's the more offbeat or quirky interview that carries the day.
Got it. How do you approach impartiality in journalism? As a host, I know I struggle with this. Is it important for you to remain neutral or to appear impartial when you're presenting on a topic or interviewing someone about something that's polarizing?
I do not go for objectivity as my standard. I don't even always go for impartiality as my standard. I go for fairness. And so what I mean by that is, and we've done several episodes on extremism, you know, both I covered the peaceful phase of the Stop the Steal rally on January 6th. I knew that there might be violence. I actually thought about staying, but then I thought, you know, I've got a full-time job and I, in fact, predicted that a January 6th style event was going to happen before the election results were announced. I was like, Biden's going to win and there'll be political violence. And so that's not because I'm psychic. It's because I pay attention and I read white nationalist and supremacist websites and communications, as well as ones from many other backgrounds. And so one of the things that, you know, I think about a lot is how can we bring more civic intelligence to how we cover the country. So we have had on people like Major General Linda Singh, who helped do the January 6th investigation, but also an award-winning reporter who, you know, from 100 Days in Appalachia, who is a white man who can effectively go undercover at certain rallies. And we talked about the difference between me covering a rally where I'm sticking out like a sore thumb and him being like, you know, as he put it, the question mark, you know, and like, is he one of us? Is he not one of us? These are super complex and interesting topics that I'm grateful that we get the chance to explore. And I don't want the way that we cover America to be cookie cutter. And I also don't want it, you know, this is a show about women of color, but we have white guests as well, because obviously it's a country where we're all in this together, whether we like it or not. Sometimes we don't.
Do you think it's important to present, quote unquote, both sides of topics that are not actually political, based in science and fact, but have become politicized?
Yeah, I mean, sort of getting to your thing. So when my whole point, which I probably didn't make precisely about impartiality, is I'm not impartial to, you know, violent white supremacists who organize to try to overthrow the government. I'm not impartial. Like, I'm pro having a functioning democracy, and that does not fit, and I'm not going to pretend. But where my fairness comes in is that I'm not just going to stereotype. Like, I've spent 25 years interviewing active white supremacists and nationalists, and I mean self-identified, from the Klan to the now defunct Aryan Nation to you know, folks who went to Charlottesville who were millennials. And I do not try to depict them in ways that are not accurate. Like, I'm not impartial about the choices that they've made, but I will treat them fairly because they're my fellow Americans and I want to hear what they have to say. So I think that like on this show, I don't have to worry as much about seeming impartial. Like, I'm not impartial about voting rights. Like, I'm pro voting rights and I'm pro people of every race and gender having voting rights. And yet I'm not going to just, you know, wax on about that. I'm going to say, this is why certain groups wait in line longer. This is why certain groups' rights are being constricted and challenged in these ways. Like, we get super analytical, and one of our contributors is Professor Tiffany Jeffers of Georgetown Law School. She's not impartial, I would say, about voting rights, but she's analytical and she's fact-based and she's historically grounded. And that's something I think we need. Sometimes we need to just call it like it is. And there's never two sides. There's always multiple sides. And that's something I think that we try to get at too.
Who are some guests or what are some interviews that changed you in some way since you began doing Our Body Politic?
I think talking to then Representative, now Secretary Deb Haaland was really amazing. She talked about being a 35th generation New Mexican, which lets you know just what a tiny little speck in the universe's eye America is. Like, the history of America is, you know, a fraction of so many different peoples who were here before this was a country. And we are all, you know, on a national learning journey, I think, around Indigenous Americans. And there's a lot of pushback to some people not respecting Indigenous culture. You know, there was the Rick Santorum comment, you know, that there's essentially no Indigenous culture, which is BS, because part of US governance was actually based on Indigenous culture. So, you know, everyone can look all that up. But, you know, I think Leisha Clarendon of the WNBA, who is a non-binary and trans WNBA player who had top surgery, is married, is a Christian, has a wife, has a baby, and who's living their dream of being a fully realized human being with intersectional identities. But the interview was also about how the WNBA owned at the time, the team at the time that she was on in Atlanta was partially owned by Senator Kelly Loeffler, and how they got involved in the Warnock v. Loeffler race, and how, you know, like there's that line, just shut up and dribble. And like, you know, Leija was like, nope, we are not just shutting up and dribbling. We do what we want to do, which includes engaging in politics. And there are a lot of different types of people we have on that engage in politics in ways that are, you know, not through being an elected office holder. And I love those. And I love the, you know, just so many great medical guests, you know, and authors like Tressie McMillan Cottom and Roxane Gay and Nadia Hashimi, who's an Afghan-American novelist who I highly recommend.
Excellent. I have to go back and listen to some of those. I didn't hear all those interviews. But I did hear the one where you recently interviewed Professor Anita Hill. What was that experience like for you?
You know, it was really great. It was really helpful to read just the first part. Like in the very first part of the book, she talks about how she has a life partner, Chuck, who they've been together for, I think, 20 or 30 years now, maybe 20 years. And she almost never talked about her personal life. And this is all in the book, so it's not like a personal thing that I'm revealing, but Chuck was quite ill with cancer. And at one point she thought he might die. And she was like, oh, you know, I think I'm just going to put the book on hold so we can spend time together. And he was like, no, baby, no, like finish your book. And I was like, I will vote for Chuck for president, you know, like good for Chuck. He was like, baby, you know, just keep doing what you're doing. And it turns out that they found a treatment. So Chuck is still doing well, but just, you know, I feel like Professor Hill has had to be so guarded and has been the kind of person who routinely gets death threats and other horrible things. And to know that she has a loving, supportive partner and that she was able to do this book from a place of real connection to her childhood as one of 12 from a farming family in Oklahoma. And just, you know, I felt like the book is deeply analytical, but you also get to know a bit about her. And she was relaxed and comfortable, and we had just a really great time.
Coming to the end of my questions, I just have one more for you as a wrap up. We started airing Our Body Politic here on KTOO, Juno's NPR station, just a few weeks ago. So what would you say to someone who is hearing your show or maybe hearing about you yourself for the very first time?
Welcome. Thank you. We respect you. We would love to hear what you have to say. I'm on Twitter and we have an Our Body Politic Twitter, and you can reach out to us. We also are going to be revamping some new engagement so that you can interact with the show, give us suggestions for who you want to hear. We want to be here for you. And you know, feel free to suggest not just, you know, your local politician, but local unsung heroes that we should know about.
Thanks for joining us on Juno Afternoon. I'm Shelley Delaney. The Montessori Borealis School has found that learning to run a business is one way to learn real life skills and important lessons about how the economy works. And in the process, they raise money to pay for a class trip. So an all-around win-win for the students. While we're talking, check out their website, junogrown.org, and check out their teas, coffees, and other products. Joining us now, we have two students that run Juno Grown, Elias Shane and Keone Randolph from the Adolescent Montessori Program, as well as Leia Skaggs, who works with the students as a microeconomy augmenter. So welcome, everybody, and thanks for being here today. So let's just start with you, Elias. What are you fundraising for?
We're fundraising for a class trip that we do every fall and spring called Odyssey. And so sometimes we go to like the Methodist camp up the road, or if we raise enough money, we sometimes go to Haines or Skagway.
That's great. And Keone, what does your class business do?
We primarily sell Sentinel coffee and tea. Sentinel coffee is fair trade, organic, and is roasted here in Juneau. The owner of Sentinel Coffee, Dave Thomas, makes sure that everything is produced and delivered emissions free. You can order Sentinel coffee and tea on our website at junogrown.org.
Emissions free, that's awesome. Elias, back to you. What can you tell me about your products apart from Sentinel Coffee?
We have a variety of products that we sell on our website. During the last few weeks, we have been producing our own blend of tea, which is primarily a mix of hand-picked rose hips, mint, and raspberry leaves.
Oh, wow.
It's called the Roseberry Tea Mix. Wow. We're selling it at Publix.
Oh, that's great. do you gather the ingredients yourself? Do you dry them out or something like that too?
Yeah, we grew the mint in our garden at school here.
That's so neat. Can you tell me more about your website, Keone?
Our website is junogrown.org. You can buy coffee and tea, and it can be delivered straight to your door. And it's free as long as you have a physical address in Juneau. We're also starting to sell Golden Goats merch. That's our school mascot. On our website, we sometimes post trips that we've taken too, and have little like stories about what we're doing.
And you'll be at Public Market. Tell me what you're going to be doing there, Elias.
Our class is going to be at Public Market, and we are going to be selling peppermint bark, Sentinel coffee, and our roseberry mint tea that we made ourselves.
And where will the booth? Go ahead.
We also have been working on making some beeswax candles.
Oh, that's cool. That's really cool. Do you guys have fun making all that stuff?
Yeah, it's pretty fun.
Yeah, it is really fun.
And do you like the products? Do you use them yourself? Do you drink the tea and use the candles?
Good.
Say that again.
The tea is really good.
Okay. So where will your class booth be at Public Market?
Our class booth will be located in Sentinel Hall, but tucked on the outsides of the halls near the back exit that leads out to Egan Drive.
Okay, so not inside the hall itself, but more like in the lobby, Centennial Hall lobby.
Yeah, yes. The main lobby.
Well, how else can people support your class business? Say we can't make it to Public Market.
Well, we have our website, so you can go there and buy coffee and tea. And you can also make donations that can really help on our trip every fall and spring.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much, Elias and Keone. That's great information. I didn't know any of that about your class there at the Montessori School. Leah, I wanted to ask you a couple questions, too. First of all, your title's a microeconomy augmenter. What is that? What does that mean?
Yes, it's kind of a fun term as more of like a support staff or a guide. So the program is entirely student-led. Whatever they choose to create and sell is up to them. And my job is to just try and facilitate those actions.
So how did they come up with the idea of the coffee and the tea and the candles?
That is a great question. I know the coffee and tea sales through Sentinel has been, Keone, has it been like a year or two that you've done that?
Yeah.
That was set up in the past, previous to my participation in this program. And then the candles was one that one of our students this year decided that they really wanted to bring that into the classroom. I believe they've made them in the past at home and thought that it could be a really great moneymaker and fun activity for them to do together.
And who came up with the blend of tea that you all make?
That was definitely a class kind of collaboration project. The rose hips came into season right when school was starting. And so there was all these rose hips in the community, specifically around the school, actually. And so we had groups going out a couple times a week, picking rose hips in the wind and the rain, and even got some donations from different families in the Montessori community. And then the mint was, as Elias mentioned, it was already here on campus in the gardens. And so that was also good timing with the seasons being the time to harvest that. And then the raspberry leaves comes from Gustavus, I believe. It's actually with partnership with Sentinel Coffee. They source all of their tea products when possible locally. And so we were able to add another local flavor to our blend just to add a little bit of dimension to the flavor.
Well, I'll have to try it. I've never had that before. And I am a big tea drinker. So that sounds really good. Well, are you pretty proud of your class for all that they've accomplished this year so far?
Definitely proud. You know, it's been a busy fall semester, and we've been making things pretty much since August started. So it's been great.
And what is the fundraising goal that you have to be able to take them on the trip?
Well, that's up to the students. They don't have a money goal specifically, like a number, but they have the goal to travel out of Juneau if possible, potentially even out of state. So we'll see how far we go this year.
That's great. And is there any, it sounds like there's no particular destination in mind, but is there something that everybody wants to do together as a class?
Yes, I think getting out of Juneau definitely sounds appealing when you can go as far as Seattle or something like that, or Anchorage. I think in the past, there's been a lot of ferry trips, and there's always a bit of community playtime and community give back as a part of the Odyssey trip as well, so that they can grow and bond and continue to develop projects in our lovely community of Juneau.
Well, thanks everybody so much for talking to me today. It's been great to get to know you all and know and hear about what you do. And I wish you the best of luck at Public Market. That's the day after Thanksgiving in Centennial Hall. I hope you raise all the money that you need and get to go wherever you want to go.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yes, thank you very much for having us.
You're very welcome. Thanks for being here today, you guys.